So we're going to be talking about cynicism this morning. And, you know, attitudes are one of those things that's very difficult to deal with, aren't they? So I remember being in a church where some people would decide not to take communion. And they, as a reason for them not taking communion, they would say, I've just really been dealing with bad attitudes. They would never specify what exactly those were. But you just knew they had bad attitudes. And honestly, if I'm truthful, I've had bad attitudes sometimes too. But hopefully this morning you all have good attitudes, and so I'm just going to be preaching to myself, and you all can just listen in. So let's have a children's class to start off with. So maybe let's come to the other side, because do we have enough seats? Well, we have enough seats. Yeah, we'll sit over here. Okay, well, either way. Okay, so does anybody know what's in this jar? I'll try not to drop it. Water. It looks like water, doesn't it? What do you think, Grayson? Vinegar, that's a good guess. Victoria? Liquid, that's true. Absolutely, there's a liquid in here, you could tell. What do you think, Kyle? Okay, vinegar, yes. Victoria, I'm sorry, Elise. Don't know my children's names. Elise, what do you think's in here? Okay, so we're going to, liquid, that's right. It is very liquidy. So I'm not going to tell you quite yet what's in here, but we're going to be talking about attitudes this morning. Have you all ever had bad attitudes? Yes, Grayson. Once, okay. Victoria, a bunch of times. Sophie. Lots of times before. I know it's something about being a people makes it hard for us to have good attitudes all the time. So there's a Bible verse that says, "Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me." And so we're going to talk a little bit about this morning. So when I was your age, I struggled with attitudes because I was the oldest. And it's hard to be the oldest, isn't it? Only one of you knows what it's like to be the oldest child in your family. Sophie, right? So when you're the oldest, you have to do all the stuff. And when you say, but my younger brother or sister isn't doing it, you know what your parents tell you? But they're younger than you. And that doesn't seem like a good reason, does it? Yes, Elise. They're bigger than you. That's right. So the bigger people should do more than the littler people. So I just always found that very discouraging because I knew that my parents expected too much of me and not enough of my younger brothers and sisters. And I had a lot of younger brothers and sisters. So it made me kind of discouraged with things. And so this is actually bleach water. Does anybody know what bleach is? Elise, I don't think you knew what bleach is. Yeah, it's something. Yes, Kyle. So bleach is something that you can use to clean stuff up, so it kind of kills bacteria, and you can also use it to make things lighter than what they should be. So if I put this on my shirt, it would no longer be blue. It would be kind of lighter blue, at least in the spots where the bleach was. So, but it doesn't look like much, and you wouldn't want to drink this, would you? No, it's poisonous, so we're not going to drink it this morning. Okay, I won't drink it, and I won't let you all drink it either. Yes, Grayson. So bleach takes color out of things. So when they talk about bleaching things, that's what it does. So it makes it lighter. So this is going to be a little chemical reaction, but it's not going to be, we're not going to have stuff go all over the place, okay? So look at that. What happened there? Yes, Elise. That's right. Victoria, what happened? Yeah, well, purple or pink. I'm not sure what color it is. I'm really bad with colors, so y'all have to know that. So I thought that this was a little bit like what happens whenever God's Spirit comes into our hearts. So he changes our attitudes. And suddenly something that's kind of doesn't look so great is prettier, isn't it? And so that's what we want to do. So a lot of times people just try to filter stuff out. So they just try to behave better when other people are watching. But what we want to do is we want to let God's Spirit come in and change our hearts so that they have good attitudes and that we do the things that he wants us to do with a good attitude about it. Yes, Grayson. What if someone hates that color? Well, then we're just going to have them leave. They'll have to leave. They won't get to hear the rest of the sermon. You all can go back to your parents. So what is cynicism? You all probably have an idea in your mind. Historically, cynics were crazy people. They lived in ancient Greece and Rome. A man named Diogenes was the most famous of them, but there were a lot of others. And they didn't do any productive work, so they just sat around, and they said mean things to people. And they acted like they didn't care about things like warm clothes and shelter. And they were pretty annoying. People in Greece did not like the cynics very much, except maybe the other cynics liked them. But when we talk about modern cynics, we're not talking about those kind of people. Those people died out a long time ago, thousands of years ago. There's not been modern people like that. I mean, maybe there are some people who are like that, but they don't have a philosophy club that they go to. But modern cynicism tends to have two main ideas behind it. It has a belief about people that they are mostly selfish and self-interested and are not really sincere about improving our world or society. And I think most of us probably say, well, yeah, that's probably true. Except, we would say something different about ourselves, maybe. And more than that, it's a general belief that things are going to work out badly and that discouraging events and depressing behaviors will tend to predominate in the people around us. And sometimes we get to feeling that way, too. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that older you get, the more you develop this kind of mindset. So young people don't tend to think this. They tend to have a more positive outlook. And there's probably young people who have got a negative outlook. But old people say, you know those young people? They are naive. And they are unrealistic. And once they realize how terrible this world is, they'll be just like us. And maybe that's not such a good thing. So as I was thinking about cynicism, my mind immediately went to the book of Ecclesiastes. So the book is written by somebody who calls himself Koheleth. And the King James Version translates that the preacher. But we believe this was King Solomon. And it goes through all the different things that he did. And we're going to kind of just touch on a lot of different ones. And he basically came to the conclusion that nothing of this gave him satisfaction, none of it lasted, and it was all terrible. So I've just summarized it, but we're going to read some of these details. So Ecclesiastes 2, we're going to read verses 17 through 23. Therefore, I hated life. So he doesn't start off on a very good point of view, does he? Because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me, for all his vanity and grasping for the wind. Then I hated all my labor in which I had toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will rule over all my labor in which I toiled and in which I have shown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. Therefore, I turned my heart and despaired of all the labor in which I had toiled under the sun. For there is a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill. So somebody who knows what they're doing Yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. This also is vanity and great evil. For what has man for all his labor and for the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun? For all his days are sorrowful and his work burdensome. Even in the night, his heart takes no rest. This also is vanity. So the preacher says, all you people who are working hard and getting stuff done, it's just a waste of time. You're going to accumulate stuff and you're going to have wonderful things that you've built, and then people who don't even know you are going to get that stuff and you'll die. We're going to go forward to Ecclesiastes 4, verse 1 through 3. Then I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun, and look, the tears of the oppressed. But they have no comforter. On the side of their oppressors there is power, but they have no comforter. Therefore I praise the dead who are already dead, more than the living who are still alive. That's kind of discouraging too, isn't it? Yet better than both is he who has never existed, who has not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. So here Solomon says, there's an amazing amount of oppression in this world. And you'd say, well, I thought that evil dictators were a modern phenomenon, but no, there were people like that back in Solomon's day. And so Solomon says, dead people are better than live people because they no longer get oppressed. I'm not sure if that makes sense, but that's what he says. It's in the Bible. And he says, even better than those, the dead and the live people, are the people who never even existed. I don't even know who those people are, and you don't either. But they're better because they didn't have to go through the oppression before they died. And maybe we can sympathize with this point of view. If you read the news or listen to the news, you hear a lot of terrible things about the world and about the oppression and the wars and the devastation that's going on. I'm going to jump forward a few verses to Ecclesiastes 4, 13 through 16. Better a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more. For he comes out of prison to be king. Although he was born poor in his kingdom, I saw all the living who walk under the sun. They were with the second youth who stands in his place. There was no end of all the people over whom he was made king. Yet those who come afterward will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and grasping for the wind. So here he takes the other side of things and he says, you know, it's not fun to be oppressed, but there's no benefit in being king. Well, that doesn't make any sense. But the point here is that his kingship is only transient in nature. You know, there's that poem about footprints on the sands of time, right? And it talks about how wonderful it is to leave footprints on the sand of time that are going to make a difference for somebody else. And Solomon would say, you know what? The next time the tide comes in, those footprints are going to be gone, and it's worthless. You've left footprints that are the most transient thing that's out there. What's the point? The tide will go out, and those footprints will be gone. All the things that we do will not endure. Ecclesiastes 3, verses 2 through 8. This is a very well-known passage from Ecclesiastes. To everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast, a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to gain and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. And this is Koheleth's poem on time, and it's a beautiful reflection on the fact that there is a right time for everything. And at the same time, there is a futility in this because we don't know what the right time is all the time. And we've probably known somebody who showed up at a funeral and was cracking jokes, and you thought, you know, this is not the time for that. Or someone who dug their sweet potatoes too early, and you thought, you know, if you'd waited a few weeks, you'd have gotten a better harvest. Or someone who dug them too late. I was at the Penn Valley Retreat for Christians in Healthcare, and I was talking to a young lady who was interested in going to medicine for the purpose of doing missionary medicine. And as we were talking, an older man, who I would say was a little cynical, walked up. And he listened for a little bit, and then he decided to put his 2 cents in. And he told this young lady, you know, you are going to go over there and you are going to make a lot of effort. And those people you treat for worms are going to come back 3 weeks later and they're going to need to be treated for worms again. And those people aren't going to improve their lifestyle one bit. And you're just going to give them medicine to treat things that they could take care of if they would just work a little bit at their lifestyle and improve their hygiene and their sanitation facilities and things like that. And I felt like Koheleth had showed up at our conversation and he was weighing in. He was saying, you know, young lady, all this stuff that you've purposed in your heart, I've been there and I've done that and it's worthless. And I thought, this is a really dark view. And I could sympathize with the view a little bit. And yet, I thought, you know, this is not a Christian outlook. Satan is constantly drawing people down. He's constantly sowing this idea that the world is hopeless. And maybe we could say with the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity, a grasping for the wind, what is the point of all we do? So then I moved, so I'm like Solomon here, and I moved to thinking about, is God cynical? So we're going to read a few verses from the prophets and think about what God thought about his people, the Israelites. Jeremiah 6, verse 10, to whom shall I speak and give warning that they may hear? Indeed, their ear is uncircumcised, and they cannot give heed. Behold, the word of the Lord is a reproach to them. They have no delight in it. So Jeremiah said, you know, not only do the people not listen to what I say, they actively despise the things I say and cannot seem to understand what I'm telling them. Seems appropriate. Jeremiah 22, verse 21, I spoke to you in your prosperity. This is God speaking. But you said, I will not hear. This has been your manner from your youth, that you did not obey my voice. Jeremiah 7, verses 27 and 28. Therefore, you shall speak all these words to them, but they will not obey you. You shall also call to them, but they will not answer you. So you shall say to them, this is a nation that does not obey the voice of the Lord their God, nor receive correction. Truth has perished and has been cut off from their mouth. And multiple times in the book of Jeremiah, God told Jeremiah, go ahead and speak a message, but the people will not pay attention to the message that you share with them. And for this reason, judgment is coming on the land. And just in case you think that this was just Jeremiah, Ezekiel chapter 3, verses 7 through 11, God said basically the same thing to Ezekiel, but the house of Israel will not listen to you because they will not listen to me. For all the house of Israel are impudent and hard-hearted. Behold, I have made your face strong against their faces and your forehead strong against their foreheads. Like adamant stone, harder than flint, I have made your forehead. Do not be afraid of them, nor be dismayed at their looks, though they are a rebellious house. Moreover, he said to me, son of man, receive into your heart all my words that I speak to you and hear with your ears and go get to the captives, to the children of your people, and speak to them and tell them, thus says the Lord God, whether they hear or whether they refuse. God said to Ezekiel, I am giving you a message and they will not listen, but I don't care. Your job is to share the message. And it's easy to read the Old Testament and pick up time after time where God sounds cynical about the Jewish people and was certain that they weren't going to change. But I think there's some things we need to remember here. First of all, is that God continued to send the prophets, even though he did not expect the people to respond well. God exhibits patience and love towards his people, even when they don't deserve it. And you know what? He shows patience and love towards us when we don't deserve it either. God gave time for repentance. Warnings came periodically throughout the reigns of all the kings from Manasseh to the last king Zedekiah. This is a period of over 100 years that the people did not repent and turn back to God. And as always, the goal of the prophets was to see restoration, not infliction of suffering. And it's easy to fall into a trap of believing that God wants to torture us, that he's cynical about us, and he knows how bad we are, and he's just going to punish us as a result. So, and I'm going to just throw this in. This has little to do with cynicism, but it does have to do with us judging who's going to receive the message well. You know, Jesus spoke to the Pharisees, and they did not hear his message, and they despised him. And on the other hand, Jonah went to Nineveh, one of the most wicked cities in the world at that time, and the people heard the message and repented in sackcloth and ashes. And we do not know who is going to respond well to our message and who doesn't. And sometimes the people who are most willing to listen are the people that we don't expect will. So why do we struggle with cynicism? Jeremiah 17, verses 9 and 10, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? I, the Lord, search the heart. I test the mind, even to give every man according to his ways, according to the fruit of his doings. So people are bad. Need we say anything else? Can't expect much of people. How many of y'all have heard of Murphy's Law? Wow, lots of people. Murphy's Law. It's not in the Bible, is it? So Murphy's Law isn't a real law, but it feels pretty true for most of us. So basically it says that if anything can go wrong, it will go wrong. And there's lots of different statements. If you go online, you can Google this and there are all sorts of things. So these are just little statements that kind of go along with Murphy's Law. And depending on where you what field you work in, you have different things that you think about. So failure is not an option. It comes bundled with the software. Experience is something you don't get until just after you need it. An expert is one who knows more and more about less and less until he knows absolutely everything about nothing. You can't depend on anyone to be wrong all the time. Wait, is that true? To steal ideas from one person is plagiarism. To steal from many is research. And we think of these sorts of things as amusing, but I do think there's a real tendency to think that all of nature is conspiring against us. And maybe it's all Adam and Eve's fault. If they hadn't eaten that fruit way back when, we wouldn't deal with Murphy's Law today. But the worst thing is when we come to the conclusion that there is no hope for the people who surround us. We never tell them, you know, I have lost hope in you. But we have. If a team is playing basketball and there's a player who is always missing the shot, they stop passing the ball to him, don't they? And they may never say, you know, Malcolm, there's no Malcolms here. Malcolm, you are a terrible shooter and we pass you the ball and you always miss the shots, but they stop passing him the ball. And I feel like there's always more reasons to distrust people than there are to trust them. I remember a lady coming into my office, this is many years ago, and she was struggling with alcohol abuse. She was in her upper 50s, she wasn't healthy, and her family was trying to get her into detox. And I spent over an hour trying to get a detox arranged for her. And finally, I got a place and a facility. It was a couple hours drive away, but the family was going to get her there. And she said, I just need to go home and collect some clothes, and then I'll go on to it. And the facility called me later that afternoon and said, where is the lady? And I called the lady's home, and they said, you know, once we got home, she refused to go. And a few months later, that lady was dead. And you have enough of those kinds of experiences, and you think, what I'm doing is not really making a difference. I think one of the biggest dangers of us getting involved with the political scene is that we lose heart. When I was reading the book, The City of God, by Augustine of Hippo, one of the things that came through most clearly was that Augustine believed that even though the Roman Empire fell, the Church of God would carry on. And do you believe that this morning? Do you believe that if the United States falls apart, that the church will go on? That Christ's everlasting kingdom will continue on? Not because of you and not because of me, because of the great God we serve. So humans let us down. I've had lots of people let me down, but if I look, I've let people down too. There have been plenty of times when I said I was going to do something and I didn't quite carry out on what I told people I was going to do. And I think When we focus on that, on the way other people have let us down, it gets us to a hopeless kind of situation. Sometimes we focus on results rather than our own hearts. And in a sense, the only thing we have control over is our heart. And when I say that, I don't mean that we are able to fix our heart up, that we can change our heart from a bitter, sad, angry place to a happy, joyful place. But what I mean is that we can give our heart to someone who can do those things, who can change us, who can give us a sense of hope. And that's what God has promised to do. He will transform us into new creations. And maybe a last thing is we get tired. How many of you all are tired this morning? Wow, surprising number. Can you imagine how tired you would be if we started church half an hour earlier? It'd be awful, wouldn't it? Some people do. I was at a church that started church at 9:25. Is that extra 5 minutes made all the difference? But it meant that visitors only showed up 5 minutes late. The point is not that we're changing the world. It's not even that we're making a difference in other people's lives, although I hope we are. What it is that as we do these things, our own heart is turned in the direction it should be. We're going to go and read from Luke 15, the story of the prodigal son, the God of hope. This is a wonderful story. You've heard this so many times before, and yet I think it warrants reading again. Luke 15, we're going to read verses 11 through 32. Then he, that is Jesus, said, a certain man had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the portion of goods that falls to me. So he divided to them his livelihood. And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together, journeyed to a far country, and there wasted his possessions with prodigal living. But when he had spent all, there arose a severe famine in that land, and he began to be in want. Then he went and joined himself to a citizen of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine. And he would gladly have filled his stomach with the pods that the swine ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have bread enough and to spare, and I perish with hunger? I will arise and go to my father and will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. You and I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. And he arose and came to his father. But when he was still a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. And the son said, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight, and am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, bring out the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring in his hand and sandals on his feet, and bring the fattest calf here and kill it, and let us be merry. Eat and be merry, for this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found, and they began to be merry. Now his older son was in the field, and as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, your brother has come, and because he has received him safe and sound, your father has killed the fatted calf. But he was angry and would not go in. Therefore his father came out and pleaded with him. So he answered and said to his father, lo, these many years I've been serving you. I never transgressed your commandment at any time. And yet you never gave me a young goat that I might make merry with my friends. But as soon as this son of yours came, who has devoured your livelihood with harlots, you killed the fatted calf for him. And he said to him, son, you are always with me, and all that I have is yours. It was right that we should make merry and be glad, for your brother was dead and is alive again and was lost and is found. You've probably heard a lot of sermons talking about the prodigal son. And I want to just focus on the contrast between the father and the older brother. The father represents God, doesn't he? And the older brother represents who? Does he represent you? Does he represent me? The older son has been burned by his younger brother. He knows that the prodigal has spent all his godly heritage on sinful living and horrible stuff. And he is cynical about the future of his brother. He's not interested in trusting his brother at this point. Maybe down the road he would, if his brother exhibits good behavior and doesn't let him down. But he's certainly not ready to let him down again this quickly. On the other hand, the father shows hope. And we can picture that every day, the father going to the end of the road, watching, hoping, praying that his younger son will return. And when he saw him coming, he recognized his walk. He recognized something about him. Even though he was in rags, he still knew his son. And he went running towards him to take him home. And he immediately set up a party. And this doesn't seem like the right thing to do. Shouldn't he have kind of given him a piece of his mind and let him know some things that he thought he should have learned in the first place? But I think the point here is that the father has hope. And more than that, he wanted his son not to leave again because of the attitude that he had received when he came back home. The older brother, on the other hand, was angry. His younger brother's wasteful life did not affect his inheritance. And that's important for us to remember. If somebody leaves our church and comes back, it does not affect our relationship with God. And more than that, the older brother had every opportunity to have a party. That's what the father said. Everything I have is yours. You can take the goat. You can take a calf. You can take a cow. It's okay. It's yours. And I think part of the question is, did the older brother ever see himself as having needed to have a second chance? And the answer seems to be no. He was always what he should have been, whereas his younger brother wasn't. The beautiful thing is not the sin, but that God's grace extends to each one. And his hope for our future and his willingness to give us second chances extends to each one of us, even to me and even to you. So learning hope, the opposite of cynicism is hope. It's the idea that the future can be better than the past. I think sometimes we get cynical about ourselves. And this is particularly true if you've been dealing with a temptation that you have been struggling with, something that you've not been able to overcome, or just a skill that you've not been able to master, a way of relating to other people that you can't seem to do well. And we tend to get down on ourselves about past failures. Abraham Lincoln was a failure. He was defeated for Illinois State Legislature in 1832. He started a business in New Salem, Illinois. It was a store, and it went under very quickly, although eventually he was able to pay off all the business's debts. He lost a run for Congress in 1843 and again in 1848. In 1855, he tried to become a U.S. senator, and he lost. He ran for vice president of the United States in 1856, and he lost. He ran again for U.S. Senate in 1859, and he lost yet again. Doesn't seem like he was destined for success, does it? And even when he ran for president in 1859, we know that he wouldn't have won if there hadn't been such a torn-up vote. So there were three other candidates who got Electoral College votes: John Bell, Stephen Douglas, and John Breckinridge. Vincent probably knew that, and I don't know that anybody else probably remembers those people. He won with less than 40% of the vote. So the vote was split, and I suppose he could have said, you know, even in my time of success, it's only because of happenstance and some other things that broke right. A couple of his quotes: "My great concern is not whether you have failed, but whether you are content with your failure. It often requires more courage to dare to do right than to fear to do wrong. And most folks are about as happy as they make up their minds to be." And I like those quotes. I think we tend to go in one of two different directions when we have failure. So when something bad happens to you, it is really important that you do not make the thing personal, permanent, or pervasive. So this is not something that is who you are. It's something that happened because of what you did. Proverbs 24, verse 16 says, "For a righteous man may fall seven times and rise again, but the wicked shall fall by calamity." And I suppose the message of this verse is at least partially that the righteous person is sustained by God. But I think also the righteous man hopes that the future is going to be better than the past. We can get cynical about other people, and this is probably an even bigger problem than cynicism about ourselves. So every one of us has been let down by other people. And we can come to the conclusion that everyone around us is hopeless. And not only are they hopeless, they're never going to improve. So people who get involved in politics tend to go one or two different directions. They either say, you know, the other party is hopeless, and if my party just got into power more, then everything wonderful would happen. Or they say everything is terrible, and it's lobbyists who run the show, and nothing good is ever going to happen, regardless of who gets into power. But regardless, getting involved with politics, I've never seen somebody who becomes more hopeful because they invested themselves in electioneering. I think of William Carey, who started the first Baptist mission in India in the late 1700s, and one preacher told him, "When God pleases to convert the heathen, he will do it without your aid or mine." And yet he lived by the motto, "Expect great things from God, attempt great things for God." And I love the emphasis here. The point is not the results. The point is the great and wonderful God that we serve and the attempt that we're making to serve him. So what advice could we give the older son when dealing with his younger brother who is not trustworthy? And we're just going to run down a few things here. So realize that you have been given a wonderful hope that you did not deserve. So the verse up here on the board, 1 Peter 1:3, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his abundant mercy has begotten us again to living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead." So probably the biggest problem with the older brother, and maybe it's true for some of us, is that we have always been awesome. you know, yes, Jesus died for our sins, but there weren't many of them, and we've been pretty good, and not like those other hopeless people out there. Realize that your hope is not in the other person, but in Christ working in them. And this is true for us too, isn't it? Galatians 2, verse 20 says, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. People will let us down, but we have also let people down at certain points in the past, even if it was unintentional. But what we are hoping for is that Jesus will keep working in our hearts, and he has promised to do that. Realize that your brother is valuable to the Father. 1 Corinthians 6, verse 20 says, for you were bought at a price, therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. And we know what that price was. Jesus' life was the price that God was willing to pay for you and me. So I would like to finish just reading a few verses from Philemon. So Philemon is a very short letter. It was written by Paul. We don't know why it's in the Bible when other short letters maybe got left by the side. But I think it applies to the subject we're dealing with here. Philemon verses 10 through 16. I appeal to you. So Paul's writing to Philemon, for my son Onesimus, whom I have begotten while in my chains, who was once unprofitable for you, but now is profitable for you and to me. I am sending him back. You therefore receive him, that is my own heart, whom I wish to keep with me, that on your behalf he might minister to me in my chains for the gospel. But without your consent, I wanted to do nothing, that your good deed might not be by compulsion, as it were, but voluntary. For perhaps he departed for a while for this purpose, that you might receive him forever, no longer as a slave, but more than a slave, a beloved brother, especially to me, but how much more to you, both in the flesh and in the Lord. And we don't know exactly what was in Onesimus' past. It seems pretty clear that he was a slave, that he had probably stolen something from Philemon, and that he had fled away. And somewhere in the process of his fleeing, he had come to Paul, and his life was changed. And Philemon had the opportunity to forgive, to punish, to call the law on him, to take him back into slavery. And Paul says here, Philemon, I want you to know a couple different things. First of all, you owe me something because I ministered in your life when you were in need. Second, Onesimus is your brother now. He is not your slave anymore. He is somebody who has come to Jesus and is your fellow servant now. And third, Onesimus has made a really big difference in my life during my imprisonment, and I would love it if you sent him back to me and let him continue to minister to the needs that I have here. And this was a big ask. Philemon was probably in the same position as the older brother, wasn't he? He didn't trust Onesimus. He had been hurt by him before. When an employee has stolen from you, you don't put them in charge of the cash register. Maybe you put them cleaning up the bathrooms and doing all kinds of dirty work that you think won't let them get into trouble. And Paul says, this useless man that was unprofitable for you is now useful. So Onesimus means useful. So it's interesting that the New Testament doesn't ever speak explicitly against slavery. But in saying to masters, you know, when your slaves become church members, they are your brothers and sisters, suddenly it becomes difficult to have slaves, doesn't it? You have to treat people differently. I don't know if you deal with discouragement about other people in your life. They've let you down before. They haven't changed, at least not for the better. Maybe you feel discouraged about the direction this country or the world is taking. Maybe you just feel discouraged by this church or other churches that you've heard about or your pastors. Maybe there's something else that you feel cynical about. But I want each one of us to remember this morning that cynicism is a choice and hope is a choice. Hope is far better for us to choose than cynicism. It's the one that God chose in dealing with each of us, and it's the one that we should choose as well when we are dealing with each other.